Accession number 33202, reel 5.
Terry Light, reel 5. And what did that mean?
That meant another change. I joined, in other words, I went from a Bravo company to a headquarters company, which was the largest company in 3 Para. And there, in the intelligence section, it was a small section with a young commissioned officer and a very experienced sergeant, Sergeant Sparville, and that's who we reported to in reality. Briefly on Sergeant Sparville, a regular through and through, must have been in his 40s, always refused promotion, as I learnt later on. Refused promotion, but what I would call an old sweat. Fought during the North African campaign, Sicily, Italy, Yugoslavia, civil war in Greece, civil war in the birth pangs from Palestine into Israel. You know, he knew it inside out. And I suppose you could call him my mentor. He really, in his own particular manner, taught me how to exist in a competitive environment called a parachute unit, amongst all those regulars. The officer commanding the intelligence section, Jim Burke, now retired as Colonel Burke, another man you might want to see actually, he lives in Fleet. Very nice fellow, but he really left the day-to-day running to Sparville, and Sparville allocated and trained us in the work that had to be done. So our tools of trade were maps, aerial photographs, and as it moved for me anyway, into instructing the basics of, say, compass work to all new recruits into 3 Para.
And were those things that presumably you'd encountered before? So were you being taught them at a new level, or?
I was being taught them really at an army level, service level. I mean, say, mapping itself, maps intrigued me at the best of times. So whether the 2IC in allocating me that way identified that, I've no idea at all. But I fell on my feet, really, in that it was a reasonably interesting task, appointment. And I was soon given my first stripe, and then later on a second one. And throughout the time in Cyprus, where we were on anti-terrorist duties against IOCA, really I would go wherever. Sergeant Sparville, he'd seen it all. So he was a shrewd devil. Although he wasn't the senior man in the intelligence section of 3 Para, he knew how to work the system, so he didn't like to go out. Now, I wanted to go out. I didn't want to be confined to camp. So with my one stripe, as it was starting off, he used to presumably suggest, I would think, to Jim Burke, look, let's get rid of Light, let's send him up country as to set up or help to set up a technical headquarters, and he can man the mapping there and do all the running around that's necessary up there, where I stay back in camp and have an easy time and sleep in my bed. And that suited me nicely, because 3 Para, when put on to anti-terrorist duties against the IOCA, the companies would never be all the companies in Camp Pegasus, whether it was under canvas or as we later moved up to the permanent camp, which I'll come on to in a moment. They were never in the camp all the same time. They were out on various duties, either up in the Trudos Mountains or the Kyrenia Range. being allocated a certain sector in which that particular company would be try and clamp down on the movement, capture, kill any Yoga terrorists of a rural nature. There was the rural terrorist and the urban terrorist. And so really all our involvement after a while was really up country, as I would call it. And so I got out and I saw Cyprus. Well, there was a stage where I could truthfully say that I knew Cyprus better than I knew England, having travelled around wherever a particular company happened to be. And you'd have the technical headquarters, set up the mapping section, and try to answer the beck and call of the company commander and his platoon commanders.
And can you just talk me through what that might involve on a sort of daily basis?
Out country, as I would call it. Mm. Right, you'd have a tactical HQ, which would also be the company commander's headquarters. And from there, all the orders would be issued out for the various platoons and sections of that particular company, where they set up an ambush there, or go on a search and deploy over there, or go on a training exercise over there. And everything had to be deployed, obviously, upon the maps behind Tulk on the TAC-HQ board, if you like to call it. It was a retractable board on four pieces of wood, and so that the company commander, or if there was any visitors from Pegasus camp, they could come in and see in a few words and a quick glance where all the particular units, platoons and sections had been deployed, whether night or day, and you had to keep that thing up to date all the time. And so also within the TAC-HQ there would be the signals, so it would be virtually signals and an eye section. Nice little job. So that really was the duties during the what I call upcountry duties during certainly the 6 to 8 months of being in Cyprus. I was put on courses, sent down to say to RAF Akrotiri to learn all about interpretation of aerial photographs. I've still got some of them, those aerial photographs now. Perhaps I shouldn't have them, but I have. I've also got some of the operational maps, which I kept. I don't know how they got in my rucksack when I was demobbed, but they did. Life was interesting. And I think somewhere around maybe March, we were moved up to a permanent camp, Pegasus Camp, which was on the outskirts of Nicosia, to the west of Nicosia. That had been set up by the sappers, obviously surrounded by reams of barbed wire. But the big advantage of that camp was that it was on a plateau and it was on hard rock. And so therefore, even if you did have spring rains, you weren't squelching around in waterlogged mud, muck and mire as we were in the first camp. The only disadvantage of that, electricity was laid on. That was a real luxury. You had lines going from each of the canvas tents. The only disadvantage of being on that plain and that exposed site was during the late spring and summer months would be the heat. Although the fly sheets would obviously take a lot of the heat, the direct sunlight from entering a tent, which were open both ends, you could bake inside those tents if you were left in there. And that fell nicely in my lap, because if I was up country, I'd be up in the mountains, and it was considerably cooler in the mountains. As far as I can see in those days, three paras task. They were allocated various parts of Cyprus to patrol and generally make themselves a nuisance as regards EOCA activities. There would be breaks, you know, you'd have trips to the coast, swimming. Minimum, practically nil, any, what we call in the army, still I think, bullshit, parades, inspections. It just wasn't on. They were too busy. And the only break that the companies would have had would have been when they came back down to Pegasus Camp to clean and refit, or to go on to Camp K. Camp K was west of us on the way to Morfu, and Camp K was the camp, it was really a miniature concentration camp, not in the terms of concentration as we associate with World War II, but it was a camp where all the suspects of collaborating with the Iorka terrorists or actual identified terrorists were kept, and there they would be kept in isolated conditions. It was a prison camp, really, and the perimeter of the camp, you had the usual towers with, say, a Bren gun in a tower, and they would be on guard there permanently, and each of the companies would do a stint there, revolving around with other regiments in the area, the Gordon Highlanders, the Marines would do a stint there. I think the stint would usually last about a fortnight, but maybe Smithy or Grouty could have told you the precise time. So that was another break, but I gather I never went on that. But I gather it was very boring being on guard duty in places like that, because you did I think you did four on, four off all the time. Must have been soul destroying. So that was the only break. My break was, as I say, up in the mountains or on courses, or training recruits, instructing recruits on map reading, compass work, etc. So that was interesting.
And was there any room for time off?
Yes. Time off would have been trips organised by the within the battalion. Would have been organised swimming trips up to Kyrenia. You could, in the initial stages, we could go into Nicosia, but then the inner city wall of Nicosia was out of bounds because of the activities of bomb throwing, pipe bombs. So you had to go around in pairs, you had to go around at least in pairs, or maybe even four of you at a time, but you had to go around armed. And I think most of us, I speak mainly of the people I circulated with, which were mainly people within headquarter company, we couldn't be bothered because you had to get a taxi in there and a taxi out, and then really you would be looking for somewhere to have a drink, but you couldn't really relax. So we used to find our own amusement. There would be a film show, outdoor film show in the within the camp, quite frequently. There was an affy, where you could bolster your army diet with what you wanted. And I suppose the at times, especially during July, August, September, the heat could become unbearable, even though you're fully acclimatised. Heat could become unbearable even at night. That would be the only downside as far as I can think of at the moment. I like heat. I don't like cold weather, but that was, you know, you're up in the 100 plus at times during the day anyway. And so I was always glad I'd volunteer, try and work my way up into the mountains where it was cooler. So yeah, time passed very pleasantly as far as I was concerned. To show how innocent and ignorant I was, I think sometime in the late spring, early summer, some of the old sweats will tell you, one and two para came out in adjoining camps. And with one and two para came the regimental band. And then, of course, on Sundays, sometimes the regimental band would play a series of regimental tunes, which the old sweats used to love. And you used to sit around drinking and listening to them. And the first time I sat in one of these evening regimental band do's, as I would call them, they finished up by playing a certain tune. And everybody stood up. And I couldn't understand why is everybody standing up? You know, it was a tune known as Ride of the Valkyrie by Wagner. What the hell's everybody standing up for? And as I found out, of course, that's the regimental march. You stand to attention. I didn't know it was the regimental march. Hadn't a clue. And of course, there'd been that gap since I joined Three Para until that happened, when there'd been no band out there, and so there'd been no need for me to identify it. So that was a laugh. I had all the privileges of a regular soldier. So if I'd signed on for whatever the minimum period was, I think the minimum period was 5 years in those days. I stand corrected, mind. So I had all the privileges of leave and being able to messing standards. The only privilege I didn't have was pay. I was on a national serviceman's pay, but of course I still got the same parachute money as the regulars. So again, I did very well out of it. And this was another reason why I kept my mouth shut, because by now, I never saw my papers. By now, my papers must have caught up with me. They certainly hadn't caught up with me by the time I was transferred into the I section, or intelligence section. But presumably they came along and they were out there somewhere. And there was a stage, I cannot define this, it's rather a subjective comment, I suppose. I cannot say that there was a stage where some bodies had found out that I was not a regular. And I remember at one of the evening open-air cinema dues, there were some snide remarks about short-term soldiers, national servicemen, which I rode over. But I never mentioned to anybody that I was a national serviceman, because immediately I would have lost my privilege of certainly leave. And I may have lost other privileges which I'm not aware of at the moment. So I kept my big mouth shut. I, again, cannot remember ever meeting another national serviceman during my time. I'm sure they were somewhere, but I think they're all minimum of maybe 3 years, maybe 5 years, and then you really got the regulars. And you've got to bear in mind that Three Para at that particular time, the warrant officers and sergeants mess, there were some really old sweats. As I explained to you about Sparville, they'd come up from, for example, the regimental sergeant major, RSM Alcock, deceased. He was one of the founding members of the SAS, and therefore he did service in North Africa, Italy, Sicily, Italy, and right the way around through. He was a real old sweat. And then you came down, you had Sergeant Davison, who'd seen service with SAS in Malaysia. Sergeant Sparville, and they're all of the same ilk. And I, from my observation, I always classified myself as really an outsider of all these regulars. From my observation, Three Para in those days was, as an ex-businessman, was really controlled and managed by the warrant officer and sergeant's mess. Because officers, commissioned officers, came and went. They did a 3-year tour. So, for example, the CO at that time was from the Royal West Kents. The 2IC, Beckett, Colonel Beckett, he was Essex Regiment. Burke, who was in charge of the intelligence section, he was Middlesex Regiment. And then you had a very strong spattering in the officers' mess from the light infantry regiments. I think the Walsh you're going to see, I think his parent regiment would be one of the rifle regiments or the King's Royal KRRCs, I think. So you had light infantrymen and riflemen as part of the heritage of 3 Para, because 3 Para was originally formed from basically light infantry regiments, 2 Para from Scottish and Irish regiments, and 1 Para from Guards and home counties regiments. That's the difference. So in the middle 50s, you still had this, to a certain degree, this tradition carried on. So, you know, it's reflected again in the flash of each of the battalions. 1 Para was red, 2 Para was blue, and 3 Para was green. Well, green is the generic colour of rifle regiments. So whether I was ever posted, I don't think it had anything to do with whether I was ever posted because I was ex-light infantry into 3 Para, I don't know. I think it was an accident, actually. So that takes us through to Midsummer.
And so just before we move on, was there any other issue about being a national serviceman? Did you ever get any more? Did you get more stick, or was it just the one off?
Just the one. Well, it wasn't the one off. It was. I'm rather curious as to know how they found out. I can only assume somebody must have been snooping through my papers, which would have been in headquarters company's admin side. Somebody would, you know, going through the papers, oh, look at all these new boys that landed. We're looking through, oh, look, national serviceman, who's he? And, you know, gossip. You've got to remember, a battalion's like a family. A regiment's like a family. And as we know, families, people in families talk and gossip and sometimes brings out the worst in them. No, I was never aware of it thereafter, no. If it had arisen, well, I would have dealt with it in my own way. But so we come through to the mid heat of July, August.
56,
where, as you know, NASA nationalised the canal. We were then taken off of anti-terrorist duties sometime in the summer and really put on to I think it was termed as desert training, prepare for something different. So it was again, I remember it, force marches, exercises in conjunction with the RAF. The RAF's low-flying ground attack plane at that time would have been the Vampire. That may not even mean, I don't know if it means a thing, it's a twin boom fighter bomber, it could be. And so I can always remember there was a rocket firing as well. I can always remember it was on one of these exercises somewhere out on the flatlands of the east of the island, in which we were attacking. 3 Para were designated to attack certain positions supported by air power. In other words, these Vampires zooming in and firing rockets at targets. And of course, I was never in that time I wasn't in one of the lead companies. I was more at the back headquarters. So we could sit back and watch to a certain degree. You know, and there was, to me, it seemed as if this is open warfare. Well, it seemed a complete shambolic to my view, but I'm sure it wasn't. A parachute unit, when it drops into an area, is organised chaos. That's the best way I can describe it. Because when you are in a plane, the transport, Hastings or Valletta, You don't get all the eye section in one plane, or all the signals in one plane. That would be, if that plane was shot down or had mechanical problems, well, you'd lose all that section, platoon, company, in one go. So they're all interspersed between all the aircraft. You come out of the plane, you know, complete chaotic, and then you're all under instructions to assemble at your allotted RV, rendezvous. And then that's where things start to tie together, in theory anyway. So,
So desert training?
Desert training, well, I wouldn't call it desert training. It was just hot weather training as far as I'm concerned, you know, being rationed with water. Told not to, there's your allocation of water for the next 24 hours, keep to it. Don't go beyond that. And you had two water bottles. You'd be self-contained. And really, it was really, I suppose, toning you up for what could happen. Again, casting back, seemed all right, pleasant enough. Sometime, I suppose, in September, maybe early October, we were taken completely off of. Walsh could tell you more about this, I'm sure. But I was in a fortunate position because everything that the maps, the aerial photographs, would come down from brigade to the eye section, and there they would be allocated out to the assault companies, A, B, C, D, headquarter companies and support. So we were in a fortunate position. Everything funneled into us, and then it was allocated out to the various companies, with company commanders especially shouting for their maps so that they could mark up their own instructions on the map. So I can always remember in those particular hectic days in October, where certain maps were brought down to headquarters, I section, but they were kept under virtually lock and key. And obviously, they, as it eventually turned out, they were the maps for the portside area. As we led up towards, I suppose this would be in November, we would be, the camp would close down in the sense that nobody was allowed out. You were put under a situation whereby, okay, you had the regimental police on the inside ensuring nobody was naughty, and on the outside you had the military police making sure nobody got through.